You're listening to Magic From Wherever I'm At with your host, the magician, time traveler, and charmer, D'Artagnan.
Come to the children. It's time to leave all our fears and frustrations behind. Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you all. Hurry, hurry, my children, please hurry. Hurry, hurry, my children, please hurry. We have been so betrayed. We've been so terribly betrayed. Are we all here?
Welcome to another edition of the podcast. I am D'Artagnan, and today we are delving back into the School of Wonder, the magic of Tommy Wonder, his wisdom and work. Today we're going to pull from volume 2 of the Books of Wonder under the heading Our Big Happy Family. And in here, Tommy goes into problems, I guess, of magic organizations and the fact that people in magic organizations consider each other all, you know, like a family, brothers and sisters, all one big happy family. And I've said many times on this podcast, I can't recall meeting anybody in magic that I had a real problem with personality-wise that I thought was just a dick, or just some were, you know, more likable than others perhaps, but I didn't meet anyone that was not a nice person, really. But of course, the problem, which I've also pointed out, is that as a result, which I think is what Tommy's getting at here, and we'll speak to in a second when we read from the Books of Wonder, is that this backslappy attitude of it being a big family leads in many ways to terrible magic. You have people who are good at magic who are nice, people who are bad at magic who are nice. And it's heavily slanted into the, of course, people who are bad at magic are the predominant population. So Tommy goes in to say here, no doubt the person who instigated this family idea meant well. Alas, the notion carries with it several adverse effects. Quite often, the family idea becomes more important than anything else and overshadows even the quality of our magic. When this happens, the family of ours becomes truly harmful to magic. For many who are involved in magic, meeting with friends, an evening out to attend a club meeting, the social contact with others is as important, if not more important, than the achievement of good magic. Given that, it isn't surprising that for these people, the family idea is extremely important, if not the most important aspect of magic. Indeed, for many, this brotherhood may be the one thing that makes magic so much fun. I assure you, says Tommy, I don't have a problem with people having a good time together, of being brothers and sisters united by a common interest. Definitely not. I do, though, feel there is a serious problem with the expectation that everyone in magic unthinkingly and spontaneously accepts anyone else involved to any degree with magic into the quote-unquote family. Is it realistic to believe that just because we are all interested in the same thing, we are, by this virtue alone, equal? I think not. We are not all equal, and we are not automatically all brothers and sisters. When the experience of brotherhood provides more pleasure than anything else, it's understandable that whenever someone doesn't conform to the family code, this person is ruining the most enjoyable thing magic offers. and is therefore not a good brother or sister. Under such a family flag, it is also understandable that a lot of bad magic is condoned, even simulated. After all, brothers and sisters are supposed to be nice to each other, aren't they? Magic is our hobby, isn't it? It's supposed to be a pleasure, not a discipline that may be difficult. Magic's supposed to be fun, fun, fun. Well, sometimes I get so full of this fun, it dribbles out my ears. When I see bad magic being applauded for the sake of upholding the simple-minded harmony of our happy family, the quote-unquote fun pours from my ears, and it truly revolts me. This family idea, which is so heavily promoted in magic, can be a huge obstacle to stimulating people to achieve. Indeed, I believe it to be a force that often teaches people to stay on low levels of accomplishment. This family idea, which is so heavily promoted in magic, can be a huge obstacle to stimulating people to achieve. Indeed, I believe it to be a force that often teaches people to stay on low levels of accomplishment, with friendship being more important than the pursuit of good magic. Because this idea of being brothers and sisters condones and encourages bad magic, we need to take a hard look at this quote-unquote big happy family that reflexively accepts everyone and everything. Of course we can be friends, but friendship should not get in the way of stimulating good magic. But oh, so often it does. It's high time we stop propagating this idea we are brothers and sisters solely because we are involved with magic. This isn't a sufficient basis for being brothers and sisters. Some of my so-called siblings in magic treat our craft so badly, they make it impossible for me to be true friends with them. How can I like a person who mistreats the thing I most love? To be true friends requires something more than merely being involved with magic. So the family idea can be an obstacle in the path to achievement and the stimulation of good magic, and this idea has still other negative aspects to it. The image of family also suggests that we all occupy an equal level. Of course, many, if not most, recognize that this is nonsense. When considering the execution of magic and a knowledge of the craft, of course, we are not all equal. Nevertheless, there are those who, being led to believe that we are all brothers and sisters, live under the false assumption that we are equal, and these misguided individuals behave accordingly. In magic, I think we can all agree that different levels of achievement exist. It goes from the negative, people who rape magic, to low levels, non-achievement, to the mediocre, to fair, to good, to excellent, high achievement. Accepting the negative level, it doesn't matter which level you are in, there is nothing to be ashamed of. If you are not in the highest level, it doesn't make you less of a person. Less of a magician, yes, but not less of a person. Most people find no difficulty in facing this obvious truth. But to some, this fact is totally obscured by their illusion of fraternity. And I would agree with Tommy Wonder. In fact, when I read the books of Wonder very early on in my indoctrination into what good magic actually is, the books of Wonder were a massive resource. It is sad. I think maybe even though Tommy's words here are pretty scathing, I think they might even fall short of my own opinion, because I believe that good magic is so rare that perhaps when he wrote these words, it's either he was pulling punches, or it has gotten so much progressively worse in the interim that I feel that his words have been outstripped or that he was being kind. And so at this present stage in 2021, it's just far worse than it was when he wrote these words. But the bottom line, the brass tacks, if you will, is that most magic is just unbearably bad. For myself, that doesn't, it saddens me, certainly, because I believe magic has the potential, when done well, to have very deep effects on people like all the other arts do. And magic may be unique in its thing because people have this notion, not really from magicians themselves, but from outside magicians, of really what this notion of magic, and they have a visceral connection, an emotional connection to this idea of magic. And so we already sort of have a tether into that world, but we squander it so frequently that it severs it so easily. And people treat it like just a given, when in fact you should be doing everything to support and maintain that tether. That I feel, you know, it is shameful, I think. And that doesn't make you, like Tommy points out here, it makes you a terrible magician, but not a terrible person necessarily. I'm sure there is some crossover, in my estimation. People are almost seemingly infinitely faceted. And so it's not like being good at magic if you're bad at magic, it renders you inert as a person. It doesn't. It may suggest you should be doing something else, which I think is pretty common, but it doesn't obviate you as a human being. There's plenty of things you could be doing, and just magic may not be one of them. And I think these ideas that he's putting forth here are extremely valid, and that's one of the, you know, when I was starting my street show, I knew it was really bad. In fact, you know, I went so far as to the people I've mentioned many times on this podcast before, the Warpos, the Eric Evans, the Jimmy Talks a Lot. You know, I sought their harsh criticism instead of getting away from it, because I knew it didn't really say anything about me as a person. And also I wanted to become better. I desired to achieve a much higher standard and to meet that standard. And so I sought out the criticism. And that was sort of something I had intuited. I mean, it was obvious to me how bad it was at the beginning, because everyone's bad at the beginning. But Jimmy Talks a Lot, who famously told me to burn the boats, but also told me to go toward the suffering. To me, he may or may not have meant that, but to me, part of go toward the suffering that I intuited was to seek out harsh criticism and to get torn down by people more experienced and better than I was, so that I could understand what I was doing wrong, etc. I remember one of the famous ones very early on in my street performing career was Emmett Miller. I've mentioned this before, I think, on the podcast. But when I didn't have a lot of good things, you know, when I had not scripted my show, or really, you know, as in the beginning stages of even trying to pull together a show, one of the very bad habits I had was to say okay a lot, like okay, you know, and even when I was trying to just say to people like, where are you from, or what's your name, I would always say okay. And when Emmett Miller pointed this out to me, because I had no idea I was doing it even, and it was really just, it was a filler. It was like a placeholder, because I had nothing better to say. When he pointed it out to me, then the immediate next show, I caught myself doing it. And then I never did it again. That was such a stark example of something that is actually, or damaging the performance. And really just pointed out the need, my need to develop patter, dialogue, and was at the very beginning of that phase of like, what should this be about? And that may have been like a couple days after I met Emmett Miller. I don't recall the exact thing, but it was like such a obvious example. And there's some people that never correct stuff like that. Some people I see like 4 years later and they're still doing that exact same thing. You got to be willing to take it on board. Like I said, I was seeking out that kind of harsh, and I developed a rapport with those people, with those mentors and friends of mine who weren't afraid to like, because I'd ask for it, you know, they would give me that harsh criticism. Because we all make those kind of mistakes at the beginning, and then you got to correct them, and that's how you get better. But if you don't seek out that kind of harsh criticism, you don't correct those mistakes, you never get better. And you're in this kind of weird stasis where you're just in a limbo, never progressing. And that's just a terrible place to be. And it really is bad for your audience. Like you obviously don't care about your audience if you're not trying to progress and get better. You know, that's really what you should be thinking about. You have a responsibility to the people you're going to do stuff for, show stuff to give them the very best possible at the given time. And if you're not trying to progress, you're not trying to take criticism, you're not trying to improve, then you don't give a shit about those people. You are only care about yourself and your fragile ego. And you should not be a performer if that's the way you're going to behave. And I've seen that a lot, many, many times, on the street, indoors, you name it. Other performers who are far more interested in protecting their ego than giving the audience their very best. And that is just a sad place to be, to see that in another person, another performer. It's just very sad. And in those cases, there's almost like nothing you can do, which is even worse, because they're not seeking out any sort of criticism and they're not seeking out any sort of advice. And hopefully you just kind of like, hopefully one day they'll like turn that around or like come to their senses or whatever, you know, whatever you want to say about it. But it's real disheartening to see somebody doing that who doesn't care about, you're really just chewing up the audience's life. You know, time they can never get back. You don't feel any responsibility. And I mean, you don't feel any responsibility for attempting to improve over time so that every time you step out there, you're a little bit better and your audiences have the very best of whatever stage you're at. No, it's the people who don't progress, aren't trying to progress, and they're actually wasting the audience's lives. Not just their time, like think about it. You're wasting their life. You're sucking their life away. You're just being wholly irresponsible. That's what really gets me upset, is when is not so much even that these people, the magic is so bad, it's that they don't feel any responsibility to the audience. They don't feel any responsibility that these people want to have a good time and they want to be entertained and they want this to be part of their life experience and something they can remember years from now and reflect back on, oh, those were such a good, what a great trip or whatever. And to me, that's the most abhorrent part. It's the same thing about throwing out hackneyed jokes and presentationless tricks and all that stuff. It's just irresponsible and callous. And it's always done by people who are trying to protect their ego instead of caring about, you know, the quality of the show and the experience of the audience. And so you don't want to be one of those people. You don't want to be a trickster eating up people's lives and just wasting their lives. Now, as part of today's show, I am going to include sort of the second half of today's show or the second stanza in today's show. I'm going to include the entire first chapter of The Secret Gate. The audiobook version is now available over at magicfromwherever.com/secretgate. Anybody who's purchased other versions, be that the digital ebook version or the print version through Amazon or library, you can get the audiobook version for half off. So the regular price of the audiobook is the same as the other two editions. So you can get it for $10.10. All you got to do to get that deal is just contact me with your proof of purchase. Or if I know you, you know, I actually sold you one physically. We sold quite a few of those too. So if I've sold you one physically or had one shipped to you, then just contact me directly at d'artagnanmagic@gmail.com with your receipt or your Amazon receipt or your library receipt or your, or proof of purchase of, you know, there's various ways you could demonstrate that. And so today, to mark the release of the audiobook version of The Secret Gate, as part of this podcast, I will be including the entire first chapter entitled A Long Time Ago. And so you can listen to that. I've put a rudimentary score to the audiobook version, and several of the chapters have me riffing, which is unique to the audiobook version. There were several chapters where I decided to just riff on what was said in those chapters, add more content, add some extra things that happened since the original book was published. And so really each version of the Secret Gate, the ebook, the print version, and now the audiobook are in fact unique. So that's it. I hope you enjoy that. If you need to contact me for any reason, of course, I'm D'Artagnan Magic on all social media. D'ArtagnanMagic@gmail.com, of course, as I just said, magicfromwherever.com, magicfromwherever.com/secretgate to see all the various versions of my book, including the new audiobook version. You can also see the new audiobook trailer, which is available on there as well. Created a new trailer just for the audiobook version. Enjoy the first chapter of The Secret Gate, and I'll be back again next week with another episode. Until then. A Long Time Ago. 3PO. Did you hear that? They've shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure. This is madness. A young lady joined us as we lingered in conversation. She wanted to interview one of us street performers, and though I was designated by the rest as well-spoken, being the greenhorn also meant I was the sacrificial lamb. She was a young, early 20s maybe, underling to the woman whose byline would appear on the article months later. We sat at the park inside Jackson Square and talked for the better part of the next hour. I had only been street performing a few months full-time, but I knew why. Single, with my dog Olive my only responsibility, I struck out into the unknown world of street performing as an alternative to the monotonous time suck and despair of the common 9-to-5. Quote, he wishes that people will see the magic in a show and that it will resonate or provide hope in their life. Camille Whitworth, Camille Knows Nola. With a flair of artistry, I had shed two jobs the previous year, and after considering which factors would improve my chances of success, I set out into the fray. You'll be able to read more about all this in the companion book to this one when it appears. And you can look for that at magicfromwherever.com/book. One thing I had learned from performing magic up until then was that it could be a great vehicle for hope. When the article appeared 4 to 5 months later, the subtitle was, quote, Man Aims to Use Magic as Hope. Though the article itself was a comedy of errors, it did contain the main idea. I wished to uplift and embolden people with hope. Whatever form that took in their lives, getting a promotion, leaving an abusive relationship, raising kids as a single parent, starting a business, etc.
Through the simulation of supernaturality, I wish to show that the world was not as it may seem and that it might cause someone to see their lives from a fresh perspective, a perspective which would aid them on their journey. This was how I viewed the purpose of performing for people, even before I struck out onto street corners. The problem I encountered, though, was conveying this idea. With lesser presentational skill and performance acumen at the time, it was obvious, even before working on the street, that the tricks couldn't do the heavy lifting I wished. Most magic focused on the tricks at the expense of all else, and suffered for it. See Appendix 1. Hence the feeling I had from the preface. A scant few people here and there might pick it up because they came looking for it, subconsciously, as a few had in the past. But I had no idea how to convey this in a more practical, powerful, and far-reaching way. A clear way to resonate with a wider swath of people. It bothered me. Like a tiny splinter in the back of my mind. At the time, a distant, though ever-present, irritation. Luckily, diving into new worlds of street performance and new habits was enough distraction to hold it at bay. Now performing all day long, I was learning fast to summon new ideas and recontextualize old ones. I began to reread my magic books. My library was one of the few things I had brought on the trip. One book in particular was Henning Nelm's Magic and Showmanship, a handbook for conjurers. Cracking it open, the splinter was reinvigorated. There, on page 5 of my 313-page softcover copy, was the following lightning bolt. Quote, "No matter how astonishing a trick may be, it suffers from one major fault. It has no point." Henning Nelm's Magic and Showmanship, a handbook for conjurers. Damn! Here I was again. That splinter dug deeper. Growing in intensity. What was the point of all this? My gut told me that I was right to be making it about the audience. The transmission of hope, though, was a vague, muddled conception without real form. So began the journey.